Hi, everybody. There's a whole other room over here. Did you guys know that? Yeah. Thanks for coming out. It's hard to make eye contact with everyone. I'm not a poet. I feel like I have to say that. I've snuck into the series. And tonight I'm going to read three little flash fiction stories. And they're all new, and this is the first time I'm reading them out loud, so it's kind of a test drive for them. First one's called Away. The canoe skimmed the lake like a giant water bug. Late evening eased in, damp and stubborn. The fishing pole dangled idly over the boat's side. Sharon rowed. They'd emptied the thermos a while before. The soggy sandwiches rested in the bottom of the backpack. Sharon shivered. John didn't speak, just looked out toward the horizon. Wouldn't it be great to just keep going, he said, to row and row until we weren't here anymore? Brows furrowed, his eyes never left that faraway point. We'd still be someplace, John, Sharon said. We'd just be someplace else. She didn't want to row forever. She was cold, and although it was a romantic notion, she didn't want to venture out into the foggy unknown. She liked land. John turned away from his vigil. You have to ruin everything, don't you? He said, just go with it, Sharon. Just believe for a couple seconds here, okay? He lifted his oar, put it delicately into the water, paddled them further out. Now the bigger waves lapped at the canoe's sides, threatened to hop into the boat. Sharon sat stone still on her tiny perch. She didn't pick up her oar in return, even though she loved to row, the steady teamwork of it making her feel secure. But this seemed different. This wasn't teamwork. John rowed, dipping into one side and then the other, as if testing a soup over and over to make the seasonings right. Night would come on very quickly. Sharon knew that. She could sense the stars starting up, and then it would get windy, and they'd have to hustle back to not get run over by a powerboat or lose their bearings. She put her oar firmly into the water, made them spin in a circle. John sighed, stopped, and then they paddled together back toward the shore and their friends and family, who'd already gathered wood for a bonfire, who'd already changed from bathing suits to jeans and sweaters. The scene, with the small spark of fire and the beautiful people, drew Sharon in from the choppy water. Sunburnt and fishless and frustrated and hungry, they hit the shore, dragging the bogged canoe behind them. It scuffed into the sand. They clinked the oars inside. John took Sharon's hand then, for a second. He squeezed it right before they grabbed their stuff, took the haul up the hill, walking in silhouette, first John, then Sharon. Tired and sore from the fast pace back, they sat for a moment at the cottage's kitchen table, sandy and stinging. I want to leave here, John said quietly. He placed his forearms on the table. I want to go places where no one knows us. I want to get really lost. I only stay here for you. You know that, right? He ran his finger along the table's metal rim, tracing it. Then he looked out the blank window at the dark night, as if he could wish himself out to that place, the black, dark water beyond the choppy waves. I know, Sharon said. But she didn't. The failed fishing, the simple routine of it all, Sharon would remember it tinged with a kind of lust in later years as she walked the shore, looking to the horizon, thinking sometimes that she saw John out there rowing. This night, they joined everyone circling the edge of the fire. Sharon nudged sticks into the mess of flames. John kicked the sand to make a dent where they nestled their blanket. A friend played guitar, the notes merging into the waves, which were like the future, murmuring at their backs. Thank you. The second story is called Road Trip, and it will actually be coming out later this month in Smoke Long Quarterly, online flash fiction journal. Road Trip. We needed to get from San Francisco to Youngstown, Ohio. Time and distance were on our side. It was December, almost Christmas. Two cars, for important reasons I can't remember, two couples, 2,521 miles. You need to know we didn't need much sleep, lived to drive, wore flannel shirts and 1950s dresses with long underwear stretched underneath, drank bad coffee and listened to the Pixies and Camper Van Beethoven, had never heard the term Generation X. We drove straight through. The rule was, after the exit, stop at the first location on the right. It was my idea. I used the Rand McNally Atlas and a ruler, calculating distances, methodically switching from each state map, California to Ohio. I gave both cars a hand-printed list of exit numbers. Every 200 miles or so, we'd meet up, switch around drivers, make sure no one was getting bored. This seems impossible to me now, but we met up at Burger Chefs and Sinclair gas stations, empty parking lots, and corner diners. Once near dawn, the exit led to a factory. James and I crunched down the long, bumpy entrance lane and pulled over. Snow covered the ground like a thick milkshake. It was freezing and fiercely beautiful. The pristine snow, the chain-link fence glowing behind it, a few light bulbs glittering with industrial effect, and jackrabbits playing, hopping, and romping in the foreground. Was it Indiana? Iowa? This was before Rob was gay, before Susie's mom couldn't remember her name, before I stopped eating, before James's last postcard. And then, like somber soldiers, they came, a premonition, men and women with thick metal lunchboxes hanging from their hands, workers starting a shift. I don't recall that they paid any attention to us at all, a strange couple in a four-door sedan shivering outside their factory gate. Bleary-eyed and pasty-mouthed, we watched them. I can't be sure, but in my memory, they wore gray uniforms, and the factory loomed behind like a castle, nothing else in sight for miles. Everything buzzed the metallic blue that comes with winter on the verge of morning. And then, Rob and Susie's Toyota rocked down the same lonely lane. They'd found us, and we were together, laughing, our breath marking exclamation points in the frigid air. And my last story is called Exercising. A belligerent Gracie wakes Josh before dawn, shoving her face into his, huffing and readying to chomp his nose. Cocooned into the duvet, Josh can't move his arms at first and is convinced briefly that he is paralyzed. He sighs, wiggles, the cat topples to the floor, pissed off, her tail up like a rattle. Josh wiggles again and the bedclothes come free. He had taken NyQuil the night before, so Josh's abrupt awakening is couched in a fog of cherry vanilla residue. His tongue thick and slimy, he turns to put his cheek against the pillow for just a minute more, and soon 2 hours have passed. He snuffles to the kitchen, slippers nudging across the tile. The phone. Josh needs to send a message to the office. "I'm a no-show today," he tells Janie. She says, "Good, we hate your germs, especially when you give them away for free." Josh feels comforted by this, even though Janie is trying to be mean. The coffee swirls its steam on the kitchen table. Josh stares into the cup as if it will tell him important news. He doesn't drink it for a long time. The cat, now his comrade, jumps into his lap, purring. He pats Gracie slowly once, twice, takes a sip of coffee. Josh decides against his better judgment to jog the cold out of himself. It's a spontaneous decision, running. It's what you do on a day off, Josh thinks as he laces up old shoes. The blood rushes to his head as he tries to stretch out his hamstrings and flings his arms a few times to get the circulation going. Josh blows his nose and opens the door. The chill is deep and immediate. It bites at his neck, but still, he will goddamn run. He's a driven man, and Josh wants to tell this story at work tomorrow, how he ran until the cold lifted from his lungs, and he was brand new, like being born again, except with sweat instead of Jesus. Josh already likes this story. He will tell it to everyone at the conference table right before Janie eyes him suspiciously. He starts the run. It isn't so bad. His gait is even. His breath comes in strong puffs. Soon, very soon, too soon, surely, sweat pours over his eyebrows. He might be feverish, he realizes. Josh has made a plan and will now execute it. His vision blurs from the sweat so that when he bolts into the intersection, it is very much like a deer bolting onto the highway, according to Frank, who is driving the red Subaru and who slams on his brakes and simply only nicks Josh's hip instead of killing him flat out like he should have. Frank is a weepy guy on a regular day, so at impact, he bursts into tears and apologizes to Josh, even though Josh is sitting upright on the pavement, blinking sweat, but very much alive. Frank pulls Josh up, helps him into the Subaru. Josh insists he feels pretty good, says that he has the flu anyway and that he was relaxed from the cough medicine and so didn't tense up when the car hit. He feels the bruise forming on his hip, but honestly, he realizes this is a far better story to tell to the office tomorrow. So he offers to take Frank to breakfast. No hard feelings. Frank is unsure if this is a scam artist or a nice, strange, super sweaty guy. Frank is gullible, so he says yes, and they head to a nice French bakery that Josh knows about from his many stayover dates. He has come into the bakery with many women, never a man, and never in ill-fitting running gear, sweating and limping. The baker walks from behind the counter because all of this is so new, and he wants to tell the counter person, now on her break, running to get more ones from the bank, about the fancy smarmy guy. He's all messed up now, see? The baker stands with his arms crossed, watching Josh grimace into a chair and use napkins from the dispenser to dry his forehead. Frank weeps again and grabs a napkin himself, dabbing at his eyes. Frank says, "I'm just so happy you're alive." Josh says, "I'm just so happy I'm not sick anymore. It totally worked. Getting hit by your car was just the thing." The baker, unsure what to say, says, "Croissants?" And then he says it again, "Croissants." The two men turn to the baker in unison, look up at his outstretched arms. Thank you.